Welcome to this new series of podcasts with the Freedom Law Clinic. I'm Khalid Hussein Dupre, senior caseworker here at FLC, and over the course of the next few months, my colleagues and I, as well as some of the students involved in the clinic's criminal appeals and civil liberties work, are going to be looking at a range of issues revolving around some of the cases we have been or are currently working on, or topical questions facing the legal profession or society in general. Today I'm joined by James Mulholland QC, the new chair of the Criminal Bar Association and a leading criminal barrister at 23 Essex Street Chambers.
James, thank you for joining me today. And firstly, congratulations on your appointment as the chair of the CBA in what can only be described as the most extraordinary of times.
Well, Khalid, thanks for inviting me. Yes, indeed, the most extraordinary of times, perhaps, that the criminal justice system has ever faced. We have now a system that was seriously unwell before COVID, but as a consequence of the pandemic now finds itself in intensive care.
And in that context, the figures are startling, and depending on where you get your figures from, they do vary. As a result of the pandemic, 30 to 40,000 criminal cases waiting to be heard before a jury in the Crown Court. Trials are now being listed for the end of 2021 into 2022. And the CBA's own analysis points to a 22% rise in cases waiting to be heard since the initial measures to tackle the pandemic were introduced back in March. There is simply not enough space to accommodate socially distant juries in the slimmed down court estate. So something has to give. James, what are the options that are on the table?
Well, let's first of all, I suppose, look at what we're facing here. As of the 23rd of August, we have a 46,467 case backlog. And we estimate that 30,000 Crown Court trials are outstanding. So that is a massive number of trials in terms of the available space. What are the options? Well, one can distinguish, and one should distinguish, between realistic options and options that are completely unpalatable. What we need to do at the moment is maximize, in a sensible way, the existing court estate. That's the first thing that we need to do. That is being done. We will have 250 courtrooms available specifically for trials by the end of October. That's the plan. That's through the use of plexiglass and in some instances, porta cabins, but plexiglass in the courtroom separating the jurors and also in jury retirement rooms. Plexiglass will also be used at some point for counsel's rows to increase size and capacity. So that will get us quite a way further. That will get us perhaps to where we were because of the restrictions in court sitting times last year in terms of the number of trial rooms available for trials. But as we only were able to deal with 12,000 effective trials last year, and we've now got a backlog of 30,000 trials, well, you can do the maths. And that's why we have bail cases where defendants are on bail being given trial dates for as far away, not just December 21. We're hearing now 2022 and 2023. And some of these cases are for cases stretching back to 2018, where the allegation took place that long ago. What do we need to do? I said realistic options. The key option that I have been saying repeatedly is that we need much more, many more Nightingale courts. We need to take the pressure off the existing court estate, which has a need to deal with custody cases and multi-handed custody cases, and move the offences and the allegations where individuals are on bail to Nightingale courts, move the ancillary matters, such as PTPHs, sort of administrative hearings, move all of that to the Nightingale courts. That's the key to really dealing with the backlog. We will then get well over 100% and the backlog will start to get down, but we need far more Nightingale courts.
Okay, but to be absolutely clear, and I think that the CBA's position has been unequivocal, moving to trials without jury, so with a single judge or a judge sitting with two lay magistrates, which has also been mooted, is definitely not an acceptable solution.
No, it isn't. In our judgment, you don't place pragmatism over the quality of the justice that you were there to dispense. Imagine it in a very basic sense, if you were selling a product, but you don't have sufficient space to transport it to the purchasers, you don't squash it into your truck, thereby damaging it, you just get a bigger truck. And so, you know, we don't want to tamper with justice, a justice system that has been working well for many centuries. We want to maintain that and look at other issues and look at other arguments.
And for those who don't know necessarily how the sort of trial without jury would work, can you just sort of give us a brief overview in practice? Because it does seem sort of fairly absurd that a judge would be some sort of one man or one woman show, the tribunal of both fact and law, ruling on issues of admissibility, already having heard evidence, and then, for example, directing himself or herself as to the necessary considerations for arriving at a verdict. Is that literally how it would work?
Well, yes. It certainly, if you had a judge on their own, the judge would almost perform the task of two personalities in a way. On one side, the judge would be assessing inadmissible evidence, which could be extremely prejudicial, issues of character about the defendant's background, again, that he or she would decide should not go into the factual matrix to be assessed, but then expect to be sanitized and present an entirely sanitized view of the facts, regardless of all that irrelevant material. Now, whether or not a judge can do that, justice must not only be seen to be done, not only done, but seen to be done. And so it's the individual standing in the dock watching this exercise who's going to be having serious question marks in relation to it.
So what is it that is actually so sacrosanct about juries? I mean, we know that for either way offences, if you have the choice to opt for Crown Court trial before jury, statistically, you are more likely to be acquitted than if you were tried in the magistrates. So are we talking here about simply a question of juries being more sympathetic and juries being more human?
Juries bring a combination of diverse backgrounds to a single case. They all bring their rich and deep experiences of life and the good and bad times that they have had over the many years. And so they bring a far greater tapestry of knowledge and experience than one individual or even a judge sitting with two magistrates can bring. And it's also very important for a different reason. We live in a very diverse multicultural society, and we need that diversity and that multiculturalism reflected in the 12 members of the jury. That's why we have so many, so that a defendant has a far better opportunity to get a cross-section of the society in which they live.
So we really do need that complement of 12 rather than a lesser number as during World War II, which I think it went down as far as 7. So you really think that number, that 12, is an important number in terms of maintaining justice?
Absolutely. We shouldn't really make comparisons with World War II when we as a society were entirely different and our makeup and our background was very, to be frank, one-dimensional. We live in an entirely different world now, where people who've come and settled here from all over the world, where we have every type of diversity and background which needs to be represented on a jury. If you reduce the numbers, you reduce the likelihood of that happening. If you get down to almost half the actual number on a jury now, frankly, you're really undermining the prospect of having that extra dimension, that you are a defendant is really not going to be judged by their peers.
You talk there about the fact that, you know, society has moved on, we've kind of developed, that why not let jurors actually log in and participate in trials remotely? What is it that's so important about this, the argument about the whites of the eyes, jurors being able to look into the whites of the eyes of individual witnesses and of course, a defendant?
Well, it's not necessarily the whites of the eyes argument. We have now processes by which witnesses for the prosecution can give evidence over video link. They don't have to be in the same building, in fact. They can be somewhere entirely different. But there are lots of issues with the remote participation that are problematic. Let me give you a few examples. Initial suggestions that were that jurors should be able to participate from their homes. Now, this, of course, depends upon whether or not they have an internet connection or even a computer. And so if we look at that carefully, as a starting point, you're potentially prejudicing the poorer members of society, and you're automatically limiting the jury pool by that very fact. Now, there are other issues. For example, if those jurors are connecting via their own homes, it raises many issues about concentration, a temptation to research matters over the internet, or to be open to influence as to proceedings via family members, particularly if that juror lives in accommodation where the family are in the same room or a very small area. And so one can't ensure the fairness that is a hallmark of a jury trial where everybody is gathered together in such circumstances. And so we're giving examples there. Another issue is that particularly with the trials that we have seen where the jury is remote, you actually see everybody's face on the screen. So it's a very artificial concept. And so you can be easily diverted by your fellow jurors and see from their facial expressions, indeed see from the judge's expressions, things that might influence you in how you assess the evidence. And so you've got all sorts of issues that really mean that remote trials just can't work. And certainly they shouldn't be tried simply because we have one of many crises that we've faced and maintained a jury of 12 over many years.
In terms of a couple of weeks ago, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks ago now, former Lord Chief Justice Phillips suggested that defendants should actually be allowed the choice of having their case heard by a judge sitting without a jury. And he used the very specific term, diplock courts, from the measures which were originally put in place on the recommendation of Lord Diplock to hear terrorism cases in Northern Ireland, where there were inevitably concerns about the risk of jury tampering and security. Diplock trials do still take place, albeit very rarely, but should defendants now be offered that choice? I mean, as defence counsel, what would your advice be to a defendant? Should they literally take their chances if it means getting their case heard quicker?
There are very few circumstances in which I would advise a defendant to elect such a trial. One of the key issues is bias, conscious or otherwise. You have a predominantly white judiciary. And so if you are from a minority ethnic background, you may face immediately, just on a straightforward facial visual contact, potential unconscious bias. Judges often do not come, certainly in the past, from diverse backgrounds. And there's a real danger of a several-tier justice system where those who are affluent become judges and try those who are in the poorer elements of society. And so there are many inherent dangers in terms of allowing one arguably extremely unrepresentative judge try individuals in our society. And we have to guard against that. It's very important.
But the recent change in the custody time limits from 182 days on remand to 238 days, where you're still presumed innocent, that obviously represents a problem for defendants because they are locked up in prison awaiting some form of trial. Judge Keith Rayner, from what one commentator described as the Badlands of Woolwich Crown Court, has twice taken issue with the government on this matter, refusing to accept that the criminal court's recovery plan and the government's investment in that plan is actually sufficient to warrant granting custody extensions because it will not clear the backlog. Is this the new normal? I mean, are we actually just facing an inevitable move to barristers either having to work longer hours, work weekends, or being forced to accept sacrifices, including dispensing with juries?
Well, let me say barristers already work long hours and they also work weekends. The fact that they're not necessarily in court simply doesn't alter that fact. No, I mean, what's happening here is we're going from stage one to stage four without looking at other options. The government has a duty not to behave irrationally, not to impinge upon the quality of justice delivered, not to force lawyers to work extraordinary hours, but to invest now in an answer to the COVID problem, which simply involves more courtrooms. The senior presiding judge back in the summer told the government that we needed 60 Nightingale courtrooms to deal with the volume of evidence that could be taken out of the existing court estate and moved into that arena to help facilitate matters. We know that if we have proper use of the existing estate, in addition to 60 Nightingale courtrooms, we will crack this backlog. Because it's not really the backlog. We've had larger backlogs in the past. It's the way you resolve the backlog, by simply thinking clearly about the existing court estate. I'm afraid it is difficult. We've had a government that's created its own problem here. Don't forget, this is a government that rather ironically closed 41% of criminal courtrooms in the last decade. And you know, that got rid of 20,000 police officers in the same time frame. So it's hardly been thoughtful about the justice system. It puts costs and cost cutting over the system itself. But now they need to invest to solve this problem.
The Nightingale courts that have been put in place, do you have the latest figures for those, and are they actually working in practice?
They are working. They're not working all of the time. I think the latest statistics for Prospero House in London is that it's being utilized for 81% of the time. I think Peterborough, the old palace, 80%. So you're actually losing a day a week with these the Nightingale courts that are operating. You actually only have, I think, out of a total of 17 Nightingale courts, four courts with, I think, a total of approximately, I think it's six courtrooms. And that just shows that we have a paltry state of affairs. We have a government that's just not investing in what needs to be done. You know, when you're supposed to have 60 courtrooms and you actually only have six, you're not really responding in the appropriate way to the difficulties. And it's important. These Nightingale courts don't have to cost a fortune. There are civic centres which, with rooms used to dealing with a large number of people up and down this country, unused. And it's simply a question of people going out there and negotiating with town councils in relation to these unused facilities. It's obvious.
So essentially the situation that we are in now is really a result of decades of underinvestment that is now finally coming home to roost. And there's clearly a political issue in there, but I suppose for many people, the bigger question is, do the ordinary law-abiding public at large care, and why should they care?
Well, they should care because they need to care when victims of rape have a 3% chance of being charged. And even if they are, their case is one of those that is charged, those individuals, those victims, and let's take it, you know, there are going to be victims in relation to that grouping, have to wait somewhere in the region of an average of 1,139 days. So over 3 years between the allegation and the offence and completion of the case. Those are horrendous statistics. The public should care about that. They should also care when a victim of burglary has a 1 in 50 chance of the offender being caught. They should care about that. They should care when an innocent defendant may have to wait with his life on hold up to 3 or 4 years to clear his or her name. They should care about that. And they really need to look at justice as not about the guilty, but about the vulnerable and the people who live on their street and who live with them in society.
And for those actually considering a future at the criminal bar, one might say that the prospect looks fairly bleak. Long hours, low pay, recently a great deal of financial insecurity, difficulties in obtaining pupillage, and a criminal justice system that is obviously at breaking point. Is there a positive message for those future barristers and, of course, solicitors who do actually want to specialise in crime?
Yes, there is. I want to change the landscape in relation to junior barristers, the young coming to the bar. I want the young to come and stay at the bar. I want to change the real difficulties that they face. I know that people spend up to £70,000 accumulated debt in getting to the bar, and then they find their progress is impeded because they cannot get pupillage. And if they get pupillage, they cannot get tenancy, or then when they're a barrister, chambers overheads and other problems mean that there's just no real incentive to stay. And we've got to look at that. We've got to look at whether or not we can change the regulatory system, whether or not we can run a library model, which is functioning in Scotland and Ireland, alongside the chambers model, so that the young, even if they don't get pupillage, can stay at the criminal bar with the assistance of others and work in a library model and be trained in a library model, so that the system isn't, the chamber system isn't the be-all and end-all. In relation to why I would say come to the criminal bar, well, it is a vocation. But I can tell you this, that over 30 years, I've been incredibly privileged to be at the criminal bar. You represent other members of society and you are given that honour, either in prosecuting an offence or in defending, and you act to prevent injustice and to stand up for the downtrodden and the most vulnerable in society. That, to me, is something of massive importance, perhaps even beyond, sort of wanting to be successful or wanting to have a nice home. That, to me, is a tremendous honour, and that's why you should come to the criminal bar.
On that note, thank you, James Mulholland QC, for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you, Gilbert.
That was James Mulholland QC of 23 Essex Street Chambers talking about the potential perils of trials without juries as the criminal justice system finds its feet in the new normal, coping with the COVID-19 pandemic. That's all for now. Join us next time on the FLC podcast when we'll be talking about more topical issues within the legal sphere. Goodbye.